This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, hello to everyone listening in online or over the air. My name is Trevor, and I will be reading articles of politics, opinion, finance, business, science, and art from The Economist, from the 41st week of 2024. Cover story. America's presidential election marks a fork in the road for Ukraine. If Republicans take power, Kyiv will feel a chill. The latest of our policy briefs. Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, visited America in September to speak at the United Nations and present a victory plan to his American patrons. The trip did not go well. Mr. Zelensky criticized Donald Trump and enraged Republicans by appearing alongside Democrats at a munitions factory. And Biden administration officials were underwhelmed by his proposal to end the war. Mr. Zelensky did hold seemingly positive meetings with both Kamala Harris and Mr. Trump. The outcome of their race is likely to have a big impact on Ukraine's future. Talk of an endgame is gathering, including thorny questions about whether America's next president might be willing to invite Ukraine to join NATO. Yet neither candidate has offered clarity about strategy or presented a credible plan to change the dynamic on the ground. That dynamic is grim. As Ukraine slogs to the end of its third year of war, its army has made virtually no progress since retaking the capital of the Kherson region in 2022. Russia has been making slow, grinding gains at high cost. More than 500,000 Russians have been killed or wounded, America estimates. The prospects for peace seem remote. Mr. Zelensky insists that his goal remains reestablishing Ukraine's 1991 borders, including Crimea, which has been in Russian hands for more than a decade. Vladimir Putin's strategy is to wait out the West, and he has shown no interest in ending the war on anything other than his terms. Yet neither the Russians nor the Ukrainians have demonstrated the military strength to achieve the outcomes they seek. Ms. Harris has mostly echoed Joe Biden's rhetoric on Ukraine, saying she will stand with the country and seek continued military aid. She has said little about whether or how she might depart from Mr. Biden's policy, which has been tempered by his fear of an escalating conflict between NATO and Russia. Mr. Trump has been inconsistent but also vague, promising to end the war immediately and urging both Russia and Ukraine to come to the negotiating table. Tough choices will be unavoidable after the next president takes office. America has provided Ukraine with about $174 billion in support, most recently through a $61 billion assistance bill in April. The Pentagon can stretch aid packages, and Mr. Biden may cajole Congress to pass more legislation between the election and his successor's inauguration. But the next president will have to decide whether to provide more aid, and what caveats to attach to it. Republicans, particularly in the House of Representatives, where they are in the majority, have become notably cooler towards Ukraine. If Democrats win back the House and the presidency, aid to Ukraine is likely to keep flowing, even if control of the Senate shifts to Republicans, as is probable, according to The Economist's forecast model. Full Republican control in Washington would prove more difficult for Mr. Zelensky. If Mr. Trump is elected, another uncertainty is whether he will empower internationalists like Mike Pompeo, the former CIA director and Secretary of State, or ideological isolationists like J.D. Vance, his vice presidential running mate. No one in Mr. Biden's White House believes that Ukraine could retake Crimea by military means. That implies that some endgame negotiation with Russia would be required eventually. Mr. Trump's promise to end the war quickly is implausible. Yet there is wide recognition that talks may be necessary sooner rather than later, and that Ukraine's beleaguered population may be open to certain trade-offs. Polling shows that more than half of the country would accept losing the Donbas and Crimea in exchange for regaining sovereignty over the occupied parts of Zaporizhia and Kherson. Some 38% of Ukrainians say they would be willing to accept current territorial boundaries if the country was admitted into the European Union and received funding to rebuild. That figure rises to 47% if Ukraine is welcomed into NATO, which is perhaps the most sensitive question for the next president. In a joint statement, NATO's 32 members said in July that Ukraine was on an irreversible path to joining the alliance. So far, Mr. Biden has been skeptical of offering a formal invitation of membership, which Kyiv desperately seeks. Doing so would come with a host of problems, given that the country is at war. But creative thinking on how to use the possibility of NATO membership as leverage against Mr. Putin and as backing for Ukraine's recovery could help stabilize the conflict and perhaps end or reduce its intense violence. The reality is that Mr. Zelensky and his allies in Europe and Washington have yet to articulate a realistic plan for how to win the war. Mr. Putin's Russia, on the other hand, is weaker than Ukraine and the West together, but hopes to outlast his enemies. Mr. Zelensky remains a stalwart figure of Ukrainian resilience, but his popularity at home is ebbing. He can only hope that the next American president is devoted to developing a plausible vision of success. Section 1. Billions have voted in 2024. Has democracy won? Half the world has had elections so far this year. In little less than a month, when Americans go to the polls to choose their next president, democracy will face its most important test in a year in which it is being put through its paces like never before. What happens in America, a superpower that embodies liberty for many people, could sway perceptions of the health of democracies around the world. A messy or violent outcome would inspire autocrats everywhere and undermine faith in the ideal of rule by the people. Conversely, a well-run election in which the loser gracefully concedes would strengthen the green shoots of a democratic recovery evident in some countries amid the biggest year of elections in history. No fewer than 67 countries with a total population of about 3.4 billion people have already held national elections this year. Those with another 440 million people will allow their citizens to have their say before the end of 2024. At the start of the year, The Economist suggested this Votorama would be a giant test of nerves. After all, over the past two decades, freedoms, such as those for voters, the press, and minorities, have declined in more countries than in those where they have increased for each of the past 18 years, according to Freedom House, an American think tank. One in three people voting in 2024 lives in a country where the quality of elections has measurably deteriorated in the past 5 years. So what is evidence so far, given that almost 90% of votes around the world have been cast and tallied? Democracy has proved to be reasonably resilient in some 42 countries whose elections were free, with solid voter turnout, limited election manipulation and violence, and evidence of incumbent governments being tamed. Yet there are signs of new dangers, including the rise of a new generation of innovative, tech-savvy autocrats, voter fragmentation, and exiting leaders trying to rule from beyond the political grave. Start with the good news. Voter turnout has risen for the first time in two decades, based on the average for all countries that have held elections, signaling engagement by citizens in the political process. Among places categorized as full democracies by our sister company, the EIU, turnout held steady, and in flawed democracies, it rose sharply by 3 percentage points. Turnout increased in many major countries, including France, Indonesia, South Korea, and Mexico. And even in the world's dreariest poll, the European parliamentary election, which had the highest participation rate since 2004. The second reason for optimism is that efforts to undermine elections often failed. Going into 2024, many observers worried that disinformation campaigns fueled by social media and artificial intelligence might dupe voters. "I don't see a lot of evidence for that," says Kevin Casas Zamora of the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, an intergovernmental organization. Subversion by hostile states seems to have a limited effect. In Taiwan, voters chose William Lai Ching-te to be president, despite Chinese intimidation. Moldova has been busy countering Russian subversion ahead of next month when it holds a presidential election and a referendum on whether to include the goal of EU membership in its constitution. Last week, it busted a $15 million Russian vote-buying scam. Independent institutions often stood up for liberal values. In Senegal, a strongman's ambition to rule indefinitely was entirely rebuffed by the country's top court, its sinews stiffened by pro-democracy protesters on the streets. After a poll eventually took place, voters made Bassirou Diomaye Faye, Africa's youngest democratically elected leader. In a majority of places, elections became more peaceful. Election-related violence compared to the prior election has fallen on average across a sample of 27 countries for which data exists, according to an analysis of the data by The Economist. The third reason for optimism is that voters held leaders accountable either by removing them from office or eliminating their parliamentary majority. There was a swing against incumbents in well over half of the democratic elections held so far this year, excluding those for the European Parliament. In Britain, the opposition Labour Party won the largest majority of parliamentary seats since 1997. In South Korea, the incumbent People Power Party, was given a drubbing in April amid corruption allegations. In several huge emerging economies where the health of democracy has been in question, incumbents were emphatically rebuked by the electorate. South African voters, fed up with corruption and incompetence, stripped the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, of its parliamentary majority for the first time since the end of apartheid in 1994, forcing the once all-powerful party to form a coalition to remain in government. Narendra Modi, India's strongman prime minister, lost his parliamentary majority in June despite having the support of a pliant media and his deployment of Hindu nationalism. He, too, must now rule through a coalition. Even Turkey's autocratic president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who won re-election last year in a poll marred by intimidation and rule-bending, was humbled this March when his party was defeated in local elections in the major cities. Even as democracy has triumphed in some respects, both familiar and new dangers loom. Old-school dictators prevented or rigged polls in some countries. Juntas in Burkina Faso and Mali indefinitely postponed the elections and transitions back to civilian rule that had been scheduled for this year. Other regimes held sham elections. Amid a war that has killed or injured 500,000 Russians, Vladimir Putin won a mere 88% of votes in elections in March, the biggest victory in post-Soviet Russia. The death of his most credible political opponent, Alexei Navalny, in prison before the vote, was an unfortunate incident, Mr. Putin said. Paul Kagame, who has called the shots in Rwanda since 1994, walked away with 99% of votes in a rigged presidential election in July. The charade was so brazen in Algeria that even Abdel Majid Tebboune, the incumbent president, was surprised to have won 95% of the votes. He issued a statement with his opponents accusing the election authority of inaccuracies, contradictions, ambiguities, and inconsistencies. In Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, the ruling dictator, fabricated election results and later forced his opponent to flee. Ballot stuffing in rigged elections means that in some autocracies, official turnout rose. Intriguingly, in regimes that the EIU classifies as hybrid, that sit somewhere between flawed democracies and outright dictatorships, turnout fell sharply by an average of 4 percentage points. This suggests that voters are disillusioned. In Bangladesh, for example, the paltry turnout rate of 42% amounted, in effect, to a vote of no confidence in Sheikh Hasina, the longtime ruler who was later forced to flee the country in August after protests. Alongside old-school autocrats arresting opponents and Putin-style vote rigging, there are signs of novel threats to democracy. One is that even where incumbents leave office, they still seek to control their successors. Indonesia had a free election in February, and Joko Widodo, the president, is set to leave office in October, despite speculation that he wanted to govern beyond his term limits. But there are signs that he wants to wield influence over the next administration through his son, who was elected as vice president, and his influence over Indonesia's dominant parties. In Mexico, a free election was won by Claudia Sheinbaum, a protege of the outgoing strongman president Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Yet many Mexicans suspect he may try to exert power from behind the throne because he crushed judicial independence just weeks before he is due to leave office in October, and he still has huge influence over his party's congressional caucus. Authoritarian innovators are also on the rise, populists who command vast fan bases. El Salvador's ruler, Nayib Bukele, has come up with a new formula for Latin American electoral success: social media savvy plus the mass incarceration of gangsters. He is genuinely popular, with his draconian but effective crackdown winning him 85% of the vote in February. As a result, he has subverted the Constitution by passing presidential term limits, stacking the High Court, and appointing his secretary as the interim president. A final growing concern is the splintering of parties and voting patterns in Europe, which has become the dominant pattern on the continent. While a free and fair expression of democratic intent, it is making the job of governing harder. Germany's unwieldy ruling coalition is racked by internal conflicts. In France, it has taken more than 2 months to form a functional government after a polarized parliamentary election in July that saw hard right and hard left parties gain support at the expense of the center. In the Netherlands, a technocrat had to be sworn in as prime minister in July because the ruling parties were unable to agree on who would lead them. The poor performance of coalition governments may in turn fuel voter cynicism and boost support for disruptive outsider parties. In Germany, support for the hard right and hard left surged in 3 state elections in September. So far, democracy has just about passed the giant test of nerves it has faced in 2024. A lawful, peaceful transfer of power in America would further boost confidence worldwide in the enduring resilience of political freedom. Sadly, that is not guaranteed. Section 2. Big Tech is bringing nuclear power back to life. Artificial intelligence needs clean and reliable energy sources. "Nuclear nightmare," screamed the headline in Time magazine on April 9, 1979. One of the 2 reactors at a nuclear power plant at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania had suffered an accident. The governor ordered an evacuation of all vulnerable people within 5 miles of the plant as radioactive gas escaped. In the end, the accident resulted in no injuries or loss of life. 2 decades later, The Economist visited the Pennsylvania hinterlands and found the 2nd unproblematic reactor still running well and enjoying strong local support. It cranked out power until it was mothballed in 2019, owing not to safety concerns, but to competition from cheap shale gas. Now, Three Mile Island is coming back from the dead. On September 20th, Microsoft, a tech giant, and Constellation Energy, the utility that decommissioned the trouble-free reactor, signed a deal to return it to service. The utility will spend about $1.6 billion to restore the plant by 2028. Microsoft will then buy its carbon-free power for the next 20 years. Having plunged through the 1990s and 2000s, the share of global nuclear power generated by new plants is now rising again. Although America is home to 94 conventional nuclear reactors, about a fifth of the world's total, it has built few in recent decades. There are, however, over 5 dozen nuclear reactors under construction worldwide, mostly in China and Russia, but increasingly in other places too. In July, for instance, the Czech Republic finalized plans for a $17 billion nuclear project. An interest in small modular reactors, or SMRs, which are cheaper and quicker to build, is surging everywhere. A new age for nuclear power may be dawning. Demand from tech giants such as Microsoft, Amazon, and Google, all of which are racing to find sufficient clean power to feed the data centers underpinning the artificial intelligence boom, is turbocharging the nuclear revival. Brad Smith, president of Microsoft, explains that even before AI came along, his firm's promise to remove more greenhouse gases from the atmosphere than it has contributed during its entire history was ambitious. Now, thanks to AI, he reckons Microsoft will consume 5 to 6 times as much electricity by 2030 as it anticipated when it set the goal in 2020. Nuclear power is well suited to data centers because it provides a reliable source of clean energy around the clock, unlike wind and solar, notes David Victor of the University of California, San Diego. The vast scale of nuclear power plants also makes them attractive. Running an AI data center can require as much as 1 gigawatt of power. That could be provided by millions of solar panels or just a single nuclear power plant. Unfortunately, there are few decommissioned nuclear reactors in America, Europe, and Japan that would be suitable for big tech to resurrect. New plants will therefore need to be built. These projects absorb enormous amounts of capital and are sensitive to interest rate fluctuations and long delays. What is more, the risk of overruns is higher today because the supply chains and expertise needed to build nuclear power have atrophied, at least outside China and Russia. A case in point is the recently opened Vogtle nuclear plant in Georgia, America's first in decades. It cost $35 billion, more than double the initial estimate, and was completed 7 years late. One way for tech giants to mitigate the risk is to bring in outside investors. Last month, Microsoft teamed up with BlackRock, an asset manager, and other investors to launch a $30 billion infrastructure fund devoted to AI. Mr. Smith, who says the fund's firepower could rise to $100 billion once debt is added, expects it to finance nuclear projects, among other things. He also expects 3 or 4 such funds led by other tech firms to emerge, and suggests that Microsoft may participate in all of them. At the same time, tech titans have taken a growing interest in SMRs. Currently, there are only 2 in operation, in China and Russia. But Western manufacturers of power equipment such as GE Vernova and Rolls-Royce have been busily developing models of them, as have numerous startups. TerraPower, an SMR startup backed by Bill Gates, broke ground on its first plant in Wyoming in August. Colco, another startup which counts Sam Altman, boss of OpenAI, among its backers, intends to deploy several small nuclear plants by 2030. Earlier this year, it signed an agreement to provide Equinix, a data center operator, with 500 megawatts of nuclear power that includes a prepayment that should help it fund construction. There are more SMRs planned or under construction in America than anywhere else in the world, thanks in large part to enthusiasm from the tech industry. Last month, Oracle, a software giant, unveiled plans for a gigawatt-scale data center to be powered by 3 SMRs, for which the firm has already secured permits. On October 3rd, Sundar Pichai, the boss of Google, confirmed that his firm is also looking into SMRs to power its data centers. Still, the technology behind SMRs remains unproven at scale. Meanwhile, the hefty and uncertain price tag of building conventional nuclear power plants will continue to weigh on the industry's growth, and big tech's hopes of powering the AI revolution without spewing vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. Chris Womack, the chief executive of the Southern Company, which owns the nuclear plant in Georgia, reckons that public support would help. The government must provide some cost overrun insurance, he argues. Streamlining lengthy permitting processes would be even better. Governments certainly seem to be warming towards nuclear power after decades of frostiness. At an event held during UN Climate Week in New York last month, officials lined up to reaffirm a commitment made by over 20 countries at the COP Climate Summit in Dubai last year to triple global output of nuclear power by 2050. 14 big banks also said they are ready to finance new nuclear projects. Pointing to the surge in demand from AI, Mohammed Al-Hammadi, head of the Emirates Nuclear Energy Corporation, declared, "We have witnessed a step change in momentum across the nuclear sector. For it to continue, a mix of technical ingenuity, financial wizardry, and supportive policy will be needed." Section 3. The World's Most Innovative Country. A ranking of 133 countries shows that the global innovation boom is stalling. Which country leads the world in innovation? Most people would say America. A few might say China. But according to the Global Innovation Index, published by the World Intellectual Property Organization, or WIPO, America only ranks third. China, 11th. The index adopts a broad definition of innovation. It includes outputs, such as patents, scientific publications, and high-tech exports, as well as inputs, such as spending on research and development, the number of engineering graduates, and venture capital deals. The index takes into account a country's adoption and use of technology, as well as its production of it. Countries that import a lot of high-tech products and spend liberally on intellectual property from abroad score better on the index. Some of the indicators are unconventional, including the number of feature films a country makes and the amount of changes it makes to collaborative software projects on GitHub, a popular platform for sharing data and code. By these metrics, the top performer on the index is Switzerland. Small countries can outrank scientific superpowers such as America and China because many of the indicators are scaled according to a country's population or GDP. Switzerland, for example, filed 5,430 international patent applications in 2022. That is less than a tenth of the number filed by America. But because Switzerland's economy is less than a tenth of America's size, it still outranks the United States on this metric. Similarly, it employs many fewer researchers than America, but more relative to the size of its population. Switzerland's overall contribution to the march of progress may be smaller than America's, but it is, pound for pound, a more innovative place. A country's score on the index is correlated with its GDP per person. Rich countries tend to rank higher. But some countries do better than you would expect given their level of development. The biggest outperformer by this measure is India. It ranks 39th. But a country with its low GDP per person would expect to rank outside the top 100. Likewise, China, an upper middle income country, would be expected to rank in the 60s, not 11th. Over the past 5 years, the fastest climbers in the rankings have been Indonesia, Mauritius, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Brazil, and Pakistan. For the world as a whole, progress has not been steady. In 2020 to 2022, the world enjoyed an innovation boom, but that now appears to have come to an end. The number of scientific publications fell by 5% in 2023. International patent filings declined for the first time since 2009. R&D investment by the world's biggest spending corporations grew by 6% in 2023, compared with growth of 10 to 13% in 2019 to 2021. The number of venture capital deals fell by 9.5% in 2023, and their value fell by 39%. Even in China, which rose one place in the global rankings, the venture capital industry is suffering. Earlier this year, Xi Jinping, China's ruler, wanted to know the reasons behind the decline in the number of new unicorns, unlisted startups worth $1 billion or more. In June, the State Council, China's cabinet, acknowledged that investors were fearful of putting money into risky new ventures and that it was difficult to cash out. Financial regulators recently proposed allowing big state-owned banks to expand into venture capital through vehicles previously used to bail out indebted companies. China's financial leviathans are not known for their risk appetite, tech savvy, or blue sky thinking. If their foray into venture capital works, it would be a most unlikely innovation. Section 4. AI offers an intriguing new way to diagnose mental health conditions. Models look for sound patterns undetectable by the human ear. Traditional methods of diagnosing mental health conditions require patients to speak directly to a psychiatrist. Sensible in theory, such assessments can, in practice, take months to schedule and ultimately lead to subjective diagnoses. That is why scientists are experimenting with ways to automate this process. Artificial intelligence tools trained to listen to patients have proved capable of detecting a range of mental health conditions, from anxiety to depression, with accuracy rates exceeding conventional diagnostic methods. By analyzing the acoustic properties of speech, these AI models can identify markers of depression or anxiety that a patient might not even be aware of, let alone be able to articulate. Though individual features like pitch, tone, and rhythm each play a role, the true power of these models lies in their ability to discern patterns imperceptible to a psychiatrist's ears. AI has been used by mental health professions before. Large language models, for example, can trawl transcribed interviews for patterns of speech and contextual cues symptomatic of psychological disorders. But text-based AI has limitations. Cultural nuances, language barriers, and different levels of fluency can skew results. LLMs have also been shown to reflect the linguistic biases prevalent in society. In one study, an LLM failed to diagnose depression in black patients compared with white counterparts. Moreover, LLMs are known to hallucinate, which is to say they generate plausible-sounding but factually inaccurate information. This shortcoming is particularly problematic in a field where accuracy can mean the difference between appropriate treatment and misdiagnosis. That is why the new methods under development do not pay attention to individual words, but rather to how those words are spoken. An AI model developed by researchers at South Central Minzu University in China, for example, looks for subtle changes in a patient's voice. The researchers hypothesize that those with depression may have distinctive ways of speaking too subtle for the human ear to detect. The system uses pre-training, a technique whereby the model is first exposed to huge amounts of general speech to help it recognize complex audio patterns. These patterns might include variations in rhythm, pitch variability, and voice quality that are typically imperceptible to human ears. This pre-training acts as a linguistic tuning fork, allowing the system to pick up on intricate variations in speech that may signal depression, without needing to understand the words themselves. The researcher then adjusted or fine-tuned this general-purpose system specifically for depression detection with the help of recordings of patients with depression. This fine-tuned method showed remarkable accuracy. In results published in Nature Specific Reports in June, the method was able to detect the presence of depression in a binary classification task 96% of the time, and was 95% accurate when asked to categorize its severity into four levels, no depression, mild, moderate, and severe, based on one clinical rating scale. Other methods are also bearing fruit. Researchers from Sorbonne University in Paris have developed a method that analyzes sound waves recorded via a smartphone app to detect various mental health conditions. First, sound waves are converted into visual maps called spectrograms that chart how a voice's frequency and volume vary over time. The model then examines each individual spectrogram for features indicative of various psychiatric disorders, including depression, anxiety, insomnia, and fatigue. Once again, the AI model undergoes pre-training on a vast dataset of voice recordings, learning to recognize general speech patterns and characteristics. It then uses this knowledge to interpret the spectrograms from individuals in the study. This method employs deep learning techniques to automatically extract relevant features from the raw audio data, rather than relying on predefined acoustic characteristics. This means the exact cues the system uses are not easily interpretable by humans, a common, if sometimes contentious, aspect of many advanced AI systems. The results, published in an online preprint in March, are promising, but the research is still in its early stages. The potential applications are vast. Sound wave analysis makes it easier for patients to be assessed even if they cannot accurately articulate their mental state or are in distress. Because it works across languages, the method would also help a wider range of people and could offer valuable help in rural areas with few mental health professionals. For overburdened clinicians, speech analysis could help triage patients and offer continuous monitoring for those requiring at-home treatments. Diagnosis, though valuable, is only the first step. Different people with the same condition often require bespoke treatments for the symptoms they find most troubling. In depression, for example, some may have issues with memory, others with fatigue, says Gavin Tucker, a child psychiatrist at the Maudsley Hospital in London. The next step, then, for this promising technology seems clear: build AI models that can help doctors personalize the treatments they give to patients. Section 5. An adult fruit fly brain has been mapped. Human brains could follow. For now, it is the most sophisticated connectome ever made. Fruit flies are smart. For a start, the clue is in the name, they can fly. They can also flirt, fight, form complex long-term memories of their surroundings, and even warn one another about the presence of unseen dangers, such as parasitic wasps. They do each of these things on the basis of sophisticated processing of sound, smell, touch, and vision, organized and run by the brain composed of about 140,000 neurons, more than the 300 or so found in a nematode worm, but far fewer than the 86 billion of a human brain, or even the 70 million in a mouse. This tractable but non-trivial level of complexity has made fruit flies an attractive target for those who would like to build a connectome of an animal brain, a three-dimensional map of all its neurons and the connections between them. That attraction is enhanced by fruit flies already being among the most studied and best understood animals on Earth. For many years, the race to assemble an adult fly connectome seemed likely to be won by the FLY-M project at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute's Genelia Research Campus in Virginia. In 2020, FLY-M's researchers, led by Jerry Rubin, a veteran fly biologist, published a connectome of an adult fruit fly hemibrain, a set of 27,000 neurons in the middle of the organ. This was followed in 2023 by a connectome of the 3,016 neurons of a first instar fly larva, the tiny grub that emerges from an egg. But Genelia has been pipped at the post to create a connectome of a complete brain by a group called Flywire, based at Princeton University. Ironically, Flywire has used data collected by Genelia, but abandoned in 2018 for being too difficult to analyze with the artificial intelligence software available at the time. Mala Murthy and Sebastian Seung, Flywire's creators, however, had different AI software. They started the project in 2018 with the backing of the Brain Initiative, an attempt by America's government to do for neuroscience what the Human Genome Project did for genetics, to analyze Genelia's now abandoned data. The outcome, published this week in Nature, is a model which paints a detailed picture of a female fly's brain with 139,255 neurons and locates some 54.5 million synaptic connections between them. Creating a connectome means taking things apart and putting them back together. The taking apart uses an electron microscope to record the brain as a series of slices. The putting back together uses AI software to trace the neuron's multiple projections across slices, recognizing and recording connections as it does so. Genelia's researchers had developed two ways of doing these things. The FlyM team used a beam of gallium atoms to blast away nanometers of tissue from a brain sample, and then record an image of each newly exposed surface with a scanning electron microscope, which fires a beam of electrons at a surface and detects any radiation subsequently emitted. Their own flute fry connectome of a male should be ready within a year. Genelia's second method involves shaving layers from a sample with a diamond knife and recording them using a transmission electron microscope, which sends its beam through the target rather than scanning its surface. This is the data used by Flywire. With Genelia's library of 21 million images made in this way, Dr. Murthy and Dr. Seung, ably assisted by 622 researchers from 146 laboratories around the world, as well as 15 enthusiastic citizen scientist video gamers who help proofread and annotate the results, bet their software writing credibility on being able to stitch the images together into a connectome, which they did. Besides the numbers of neurons and synapses in the fly brain, Flywire's researchers have also counted the number of types of neurons, 8,577, and calculated the combined length, 149.2 meters, of the message-carrying axons that connect cells. More important still, they have enabled the elucidation not only of a neuron's links with its nearest neighbors, but also the links those neurons have with those farther afield. Neural circuitry can thus be studied in its entirety. The project's researchers have more than doubled the number of known cell types in the fly's all-important optic lobes and shown how the new cell types connect in circuits that deal with different elements of vision, including motion, objects, and colors. This sort of thing is scientifically interesting. But to justify the dollars spent on them, projects such as FlyM and Flywire should also serve two practical goals. One is to improve the technology of connectome construction so that it can be used on larger and larger targets, eventually, perhaps, including the brains of Homo sapiens. The other is to discover to what extent non-human brains can act as models for human ones, in particular, models that can be experimented on in ways that will be approved by ethics committees. Here, evolutionary biology gets involved. Fruit flies and humans are on the opposite sides of a 670 million-year-old division splitting bilaterally symmetrical animals into two groups, protosomes and deuterosomes. This separation almost certainly predates the evolution of brains, meaning the brains of insects, which are protosomes, and those of vertebrates, deuterosomes, have separate origins. Drawing conclusions about one from the other is thus a risky business. This should not matter for long. Several groups are currently working on mouse connectomes, bits of which have already been put together. Though Genelia has no plans to go in this direction, Dr. Rubin, who is, along with several other researchers from Genelia, a co-author of part of the package of 9 Nature papers, reckons a complete mouse connectome could be created in a decade if someone were willing to stump up $1 billion to pay for it. By analogy with the Human Genome Project, where the technology became steadily cheaper as things scaled up, this would also bring down the cost to a point where smaller connectomes, like those of flies, could be mass-produced. The deuterosome protosome division, together with more recent evolutionary shifts, also offers the possibility of a new science of comparative connectomology. In some cases, it is already clear that giving natural selection multiple bites at the cherry has resulted in more than one solution to the same problem. The overarching organization of the neurons in fly brains and vertebrate brains, for example, is completely different. In other instances, though, both brains seem to work in the same way, suggesting that might be the optimal way of doing things. These natural experiments, the circuit diagrams of which connectomes will make available, might even help human computer scientists. Brains are, after all, pretty successful information processors, so reproducing them in silicon could be a good idea. As it is AI models which have made connectomics possible, it would be poetic if connectomics could, in turn, help develop better AI models. Section 6. A Nobel Prize for the Discovery of MicroRNA. These tiny molecules regulate genes and control how cells develop and behave. Before the committee that awards the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine made its announcement on October 7th, the speculation about which discovery would win ranged from the revolution in the treatment of obesity to cancer-causing genes, from understanding the gut microbiome to perhaps even the mapping of the human genome itself, something that has still not earned the coveted call from Sweden. The broad trends in what ends up winning the prize are plain. They increasingly recognize the smallest advances at the molecular and cellular level, rather than work on physiology or organs, because that is where the most exciting scientific frontiers are to be found. This year's announcement continued that trend, with the prize awarded jointly to Victor Ambros and Gary Rovkin for their discovery of microRNA, or miRNA, and its role in post-transcriptional gene regulation. These are a class of small molecules composed of only 20 to 24 nucleotides, the ACGU letters of the genome, and they play a key role in how cells work. Inside the nucleus of every human cell is a full set of instructions, the genome, for creating a person. A key question in biology is how the same set of genes and instructions can lead to such different types of cells in the body, from muscle to nerve to liver cells. The answer to that, not all the genes within a nucleus are switched on. Different types of cells follow their own developmental pathways by selecting only the genetic instructions that are relevant to their growth and development. The selection necessary for each cell type is controlled by the miRNA molecules discovered by Professors Ambros and Rovkin. They work primarily by binding to target parts of another molecule within cells, known as messenger RNA or mRNA, which carries information from the DNA of the genome to the protein-making factories within cells. By interfering with mRNA molecules, miRNA can alter or prevent the production of proteins. Underscoring the growing importance of this area of molecular biology, mRNA was itself the subject of the Nobel Prize last year. Finding miRNAs in 1993 paved the way to the understanding today that there are over 1,000 of those small molecules within our cells. Discovery has had far-reaching implications in biology. Abnormal regulation by miRNA molecules can contribute to cancer and epilepsy. Mutations in genes that code for miRNA molecules have been found to cause conditions such as congenital hearing loss and are thought to be involved in the pathology of many eye disorders such as cataracts, glaucoma, and macular degeneration. The miRNA molecules are also thought to be important in numerous bone diseases, such as osteoporosis, osteosarcoma, and bone metastasis. Professors Ambrose and Rovkin, who worked at the same lab in the late 1980s at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and went on to become professors at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and Harvard Medical School, respectively, discovered miRNA molecules using a key tool of biological inquiry, the roundworm Canor habditus elegans. By looking at two mutant strains of worms that had defects in the genes that dictated how the animals developed and worked, the researchers showed that a gene called LIN4 produced an unusually short RNA molecule that not only did not code for any proteins, but which seemed to inhibit the activity of another gene. In awarding the prize, the Nobel Committee noted that when the scientists published their results, they met an almost deafening silence from the scientific community. The unusual mechanism of gene regulation in C. elegans was assumed to be a particular peculiarity of that organism and not of relevance to humans or other more complex organisms. That view eventually shifted as it became clear that genes that encode for miRNAs were found throughout the animal kingdom. Novo Nordisk, a Danish pharmaceutical giant, is one of the firms trying to make medicines using miRNAs. This year it acquired Cardior, a German firm whose lead drug candidate, CDR132L, works by blocking a particular miRNA in the hope of helping patients with chronic heart failure and cardiac hypertrophy, the thickening and stiffening of the walls of the heart. This year's prize highlights the continuing trend of recognizing discoveries at the molecular level. Recently, several Nobel Prizes have been awarded to technologies that have had obvious clinical applications, such as cancer immunotherapy in 2018 and gene editing in 2020. It is perhaps no surprise that, as the technology for molecular and genetic research has improved, scientists are gaining ever more insight into cellular function and are therefore able to make more profound and useful discoveries with them. Section 7. What makes a good manager? Hint: not someone who says, "I am a good manager." The Ig Nobel Awards, an annual ceremony for laugh-out-loud scientific papers, celebrate the joyfully improbable nature of much academic research. One of this year's Ig Nobel winners, Factors Involved in the Ejection of Milk, was published in 1941 and tests whether fear causes cows to involuntarily drain their udders. Its authors drew their conclusions by placing a cat on the cow's back and repeatedly exploding paper bags beside it. Genetic determinism and hemispheric influence in hair whorl formation, another winner, asks whether hair tends to swirl in the same direction depending on which hemisphere you live in. Sometimes you come across an academic paper that asks a deeply practical question in a refreshingly plain way. How do you find a good manager? A new study by Ben Weidman of the Harvard Kennedy School and his co-authors sits in this category. Answering that question well is important. Other research, to say nothing of the experience of everyday everybody everywhere, shows that variations in the quality of management help explain differences in performance between companies and even between countries. Yet a survey conducted last year by the Chartered Management Institute in Britain found that 4 in every 5 people entering management had received no formal training, and loads of bosses accrue managerial responsibilities for reasons unrelated to their ability to discharge them. Another paper by Alan Benson of the Carlson School of Management and his co-authors looked at the career paths of thousands of sales workers in over 200 American firms. They found that better sales performance increased the likelihood of people being promoted, but was also associated with worse performance among their new subordinates. The Peter Principle, the idea that people rise up the ladder if they do their current job well until they reach a job at which they are incompetent, appears to be live and well. How, then, should managers be selected? The study by Mr. Weidman and team sought to answer that question by running a series of repeated experiments in which participants were randomly assigned to three-person teams of one manager and two subordinates. Each member of the team, including the manager, had to complete a number of problem-solving tasks. The manager's job was to assign people to the task they were most suited to, monitor their performance and reassign them as needed, and keep them motivated. In the real world, bosses do more things, but this captures a big part of their role. The researchers found that a competent manager had about twice as much impact on the team's performance as a competent worker. More usefully, they also found out which traits were associated with good and bad managerial performance. Teams run by people who said they really, really wanted to be managers performed worse than those who were assigned to lead them by chance. Self-promoting types tended to be overconfident about their own abilities. In a huge shock, they also tended to be men. If appointing a manager just because he sticks his hand up and says he can read people is not a great selection strategy, what would be better? The researchers found that good managerial outcomes were associated with certain skills. One in particular stood out. People who did well on a test of economic IQ developed by researchers at Harvard called the assignment game, in which you have to quickly spot patterns in the performance data of fictional workers and match them to the tasks they are best at. Anyone can play this game online. You end up with a percentile score and a mild headache. Since the assignment game is similar to the experiment in the study, you would expect people who were good at one to shine in the other. But for David Deming, also of the Harvard Kennedy School and another of the paper's authors, that is precisely the point. Management tasks can be identified, codified, and incorporated into selection processes. That is a better way of choosing bosses than drawing only on those who thrust themselves forward or looking at how people perform in other jobs. There are echoes here of a paper by Alessandro Plucino of the University of Catania and his co-authors, who found that it was better to promote people at random than based on how well they did their current role. That won an Ig Nobel in 2010. Just because something is funny doesn't mean it should be dismissed. Well, that's all the time I have for today, but thank you again for tuning in. You've been listening to this week's edition of The Economist. This is Trevor, wishing you a good rest of your day.